Welcome to the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Back 9 Report, presented by eDraft.com. We go live every Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, checking on the world of golf to bring you the latest news, insights, analysis, interviews. Hey, we cover anything and everything golf. My name is Carlos Torres. Like every week, I'm alongside my co-host Fred Alveda. I wasn't last week, so our European guru, Kian Clark, was with us, and he's back also this week because it's Open Championship week. So I'm going to bring in Kieran first. Kieran, thank you for filling in for me last week, and welcome back this week. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Carlos, and I'm feeling very well. It's good to have you back on the show, and obviously it's a wonderfully exciting week here. Really the greatest week every 5 years, I would say. The Open Championship, the game's oldest major, being played at the most historic golf course in the world in St. Andrews. And really there's no finer venue in golf than the old town of St. Andrews. And it's just a wonderful week, a great celebration of the heritage of the game from the past to the present, and making even more great moments and memories this week. So there's so many great storylines going into the old course this year, and it's going to be, as always, a real spectacle. So I'm really excited to talk about it this evening.
Great. And Fred, hi, how are you today?
Carlos, we are glad to have you back. I'm happy that the boat didn't get lost in the Bermuda Triangle or capsize or run aground or some other misfortune happened to you. And we are so lucky to have Kieran for a second straight week come in and help us out on the European golf coverage. And, hey, the U.S. Women's Open identified a new superstar for the LPGA Tour. Ricky and Jordan both post come from behind wins last weekend. Plus, it's time for the Open Championship at St. Andrews. Let's go.
Let's go, and let's start with the weekend backspin and the LPGA. We have to start with the only major in the schedule last weekend. 20-year-old South Korean In Ki-shun, she used a stunning back nine on Sunday to rally and win the U.S. Women's Championship, Open Championship. She birdied three in a row before bogey at the last, but close with a 4-under 68 to earn her first LPGA Tour at 8-under par. She became the first player to win this championship in her first try since Birdie Kim did it in 2005. She was previously ranked number 20 in the world. She rose 10 spots right now to number 10 thanks to her first career major title. The third round leader, Amy Yang, also bogeyed the last two and won back at 7-under. World number one in Bay Park, and last year's runner-up, Stacey Lewis, shared third place at 5-under, while the latest teenage sensation, Brooke Henderson, she fired a 4-under 66 to rally for a share of fifth place. She was joined there at 3-under by Morgan Pressel, Jane Park, Chio Oyama, Soyeon Ryu, and Pernilla Lindbergh. Last year's champion, Michelle Wee, she took 11th at 2-under, while Lydia Ko and Min Lee were one back at 1-under. Megan Kang was the highest amateur at 5-over. On the PGA Tour, like you mentioned, hey, Jordan Spieth, he birdied four of the last five holes on the back nine Sunday to force a playoff. Then he parred the second extra hole to defeat Tom Gillis and win the John Deere Classic for a second time. Spieth, he closed with a 3-under to meet Gillis at 20-under. Gillis, who was three groups ahead of Spieth, fired a 7-under 64. Great final round there to join him in the playoff. Spieth, right now with a win, closed the gap even more on Rory McIlroy's lead for the world's number one spot. He improved by 0.45 average points up to 11.29, while McIlroy dropped 0.18 average points to 12.51. The duo remains 1-2 in the world. And McIlroy, like we know, will not be able to defend his title at this week's Open Championship due to an ankle injury. So Spieth has some more to do catching up. Some facts on him: he's the first player with four victories in a season before the Open Championship since Tiger Woods won five times in 2000 before the season's third major. He's one win shy of tying Woods for the most career wins before the age of 22. Woods was the last player with four more victories in a season in 2013. And if you want to know if Tom Gillis have been around for a while, hey, His first year on the PGA Tour was 1993. That was the year that Jordan Spieth was born. And on the European Tour, Ricky Fowler, he rallied down the stretch and birdied the 72nd hole in Sunday's final round to win the Scottish Open by one shot on the championship course at Golan Golf Club, and finished the week at 12 under. Is his second win of the season and the first of his career on the European Tour. Heading to the final four holes, he was two backs of the lead following a bogey on 14, but he birdied three of those four holes to come away with the win. Matt Kuchar, who held the outright lead late prior to Fowler's surge, he finished one shot back at 11 under, tied for second alongside Rafael Jacquelin. Hey, Fred, how about this weekend? Backspin, great wins by Jordan Spieth, Ricky Fowler, and the new sensation there, 20-year-old South Korean Engage Jung.
Yeah, did you happen to see her smiling all the way to her win at the U.S. Women's Open? As you mentioned, it was the only major championship of the week. It was just her fifth start on the LPGA Tour. She fired that final round 66 to vault past Amy Yang and Stacey Lewis. Since joining the Korean Ladies Professional Golf Association in 2013, Jun has six wins and is now number 10 in the Rolex rankings. Have you ever seen a golfer smile as much as she does? Didn't know you could play golf and have that much fun at the same time. That's just not right. Even when she hit an errant shot, which wasn't too often, she sported a huge smile. Hard not to like this young lady. Amy Yang had held the 54-hole lead at 8 under par, but her 1-over 71 on Sunday just didn't quite get it done. Stacey Lewis was in contention, but two double bogeys sealed her fate. She ended up tied with Envy for third. Teenage sensation Brooke Henderson probably secured her 2016 LPGA Tour card by shooting 68-66 on the weekend to finish tied for fifth. She earns $146,000. That puts her near the $500,000 mark for the year. That right now, she would be 16th on the money list, and I'm going to have a rant about this after a while, so I'm not going to talk any more about that right now.
Ooh.
But Scottish Open, I know Kieran's just dying to talk about that, so I won't go into too much detail just for the fact it was great watching Ricky Fowler post three birdies down the stretch in his final four holes to catch Matt Kuchar, who was in the clubhouse. Come from behind wins, they're becoming a routine for Fowler. Just another ho-hum. Collected €760,000 for the first place, moved to number five in official world golf rankings, and he's on a roll heading into St. Andrews this week. John Deere, what can you say? Jordan moves slightly closer to Rory for the number one spot. You know, they had the playoff. Tom Gillis, where in the hell has he been for like 5 years? All of a sudden he pops up. And I do want to point out, though, that Spieth brought a lot of eyes to golf. CBS reported a 133% increase over the 2014 John Deere Classic. We're talking the John Deere Classic here, guys, a tournament that hardly anyone east of Chicago even bothers to watch. He's having a tiger-like pull on the TV audience. And if you missed it in all the hype surrounding it with Jordan there, the John Deere signed a new 7-year extension with PGA Tour, and this event was nearly dead on arrival a few years ago. Now it got a strong pulse and good to go till 2023. And Champions Tour, journeyman professional Jerry Smith won the Encompass Championship in Chicago, posted 2 under par 70 on Sunday to hold off charging David Frost. It was his first ever title in the U.S. Smith had played on the PGA Tour but lost his card in 2007. Been a club pro before turning 50 and earned his Champions Tour card for this season. I'll turn it back to you, Carlos.
Oh, Kieran, come on. Tell me about the Scottish Open and anything else on the weekend backswing. Come on, let us know.
Well, I think the Scottish Open, first of all, was a real successful event. You know, going to a new venue in Gullan down in East Lothian, a composite course there, and it is one of the kind of underrated courses in Scotland. It's a fine test. And that, you know, we saw a variety of conditions as well during the week. So the guys who are paying for the Open Championship, they got to play in kind of softer, calm conditions in the first couple of days, and scoring was consequently very low. Then the weekend, the wind picked up, particularly in the first half of the final round, and it was really tough, and it separated the players for that reason. And Ricky Fowler, I think, in a finish that was very reminiscent of what he did at the Players' Championship back in May, that incredible finish he had there, this was very similar to that. You know, he's kind of, for so long, Ricky was always seen as being a style rather than substance player in the minds of some people who still have thought, well, yeah, he's a high profile and he's a real popular figure, but he only has one win on the tour. Well, he's put that to right this year, and he's shown that he has the strength of character, strength of mind and the game to finish, you know, strongly down the stretch and win big events this week here. You know, winning internationally as well is an important thing for a player, and it sets him up really well for the Open Championship, obviously, and of course he can recover from that really bad showing he had at Chambers Bay. So Ricky, you know, he's someone who has a great love and affection for Lynx Golf. It began at the Walker Cup back in 2007 when he played there for the US at Royal County down in Northern Ireland. He loved that course, and then he played in the Open at St Andrews 5 years ago, played well there, played really well at St George's the year after that, and also, of course, finished second last year to Roy McIlroy at Royal Liverpool. So Ricky's someone who embraces the challenge of Lynx Golf. He enjoys it. He likes to shape shots in the wind. He's got a really good attitude, which is very important when you have the bad bounces or when the weather goes against you. And with this win behind him, the confidence is now going to be up, and he'll be trying to do what Phil Mickelson did 2 years ago and win the Open Championship, having won the Scottish the week before. So Ricky is all set. And I must say, one thing about the Scottish Open also was the performance of Daniel Brooks, who in the end finished seventh. He's a player who led after Friday and Saturday, and a guy who had missed 13 straight cuts in the tour until before the French Open. And he went to be completely 501 shot to win the event, and he led there, and he held it together under all that pressure, the biggest rounds of his career, trying to keep his card, and he finished seventh there. Like, he'll keep his card for next year, and he's gotten to the Open Championship, so a real pleasure for him and a real achievement. But Ricky Fowler, obviously fantastic. And elsewhere, you know, the US Women's Open, Injee Chun, another, you know, superstar from Korea, and a player who obviously is somewhat unheralded over in the United States, but you look at her record in Korea and Japan, winning multiple times, as Fred said, and you look at the quality of players coming out of that country, so in that area. So to win events in that level, it's clear sign that she's a fantastic player and a tremendous victory. I believe she's actually 20 years old, the third youngest winner of the US Women's Open. And obviously Brooke Henderson, 17 years old, you know, to just about keep her card or actually gain her card on the LPGA Tour. Now, obviously, she's been fighting against the forces all year, trying to get into events and trying to, you know, get her status, and she's finally going to get that, so that's fantastic. We'll see her in a couple of weeks at the Women's British Open at Turnberry. Well, if Donald Trump, we'll see what happens there. But and obviously in the John Deere Classic, Jordan Spieth, remarkable. The third player in history to win five events in the PGA Tour before turning 22, alongside Horton Smith and Tiger Woods. And he knocked off any rust that he had from his two-week break after winning the US Open. And certainly confidence-wise, he's unsurpassed going into the Open Championship. Questions do remain, however, whether it was the correct preparation in terms of coming over to the Scotland on Monday afternoon, just into the time change, getting used to Lynx Golf. But, you know, Jordan Spieth, he's already shown he has a real taste and a real desire and a real strength and a real ability to do and achieve and remarkable things. So, you know, who to say he can't win it, and he won the Open Championship. And Tom Gillis, he'll be going to the Open as well this week. You know, a real breakthrough for him. 46, he's a guy who played in all different tours. He played in the European Tour, in fact, for 4 years around the turn of a century. Obviously, it would have been a real, you know, a real life changer for him if he actually won the event, but finishing second is pretty good as well. So, and look at Danny Lee, continuing his fine form from winning at the Greenbrier, almost won the John Deere as well. So, a lot of great stories, and obviously, it sets us up for a really fascinating week at the Open Championship.
And we can wait for that to come this weekend and see if Jordan Spieth can win the third straight major, and we're going to be talking about that in our main subject on the practice range. But right now, we're going to end up the Weekend Backspin that wraps up that segment for us, and we're going to start now on the Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. Fred is going to tee it off, and hey, Donald Trump is still at the top of the news, and unbelievable, he's still here too. So Fred, what's up with Donald Trump? What do you have for us with it?
Yeah, Donald still at the top of the polls and the news, right where he wants to be. He received more snubs from golf's leading organizations this week, and he fired off a somewhat snide letter to LPGA Tour Commissioner Michael Wan, but still nothing from the European Tour or the RNA. The PGA of America decided to move their Grand Slam of golf from Trump National in L.A. in response to Donald's negative illegal immigrant comments of last week. The players don't even show up for the Grand Slam of golf. They have to get Padraig Harrington to fill in. And besides, does anyone even watch the Grand Slam of golf anymore? This is not a big deal, guys. The PGA comes off as doing something to Donald, but in reality, it's not even a hand slap. Mike Davis, executive director of the USGA, said last week in a press conference at the U.S. Women's Open, "I can't speak for the other golf organizations, but I can for the USGA say that we have not wanted to get involved in politics, presidential politics. But at the same time, we are about diversity, about inclusion, about growing the game." USGA executive Mike Drecker said, "We are evaluating things, and at this point, that's all we can say." So the USGA is evaluating, guys. They're evaluating. Mike Perkey, editor-in-chief of Global Golf Post, wrote a scathing article last week, and this week reported on thousands of tweets and letters he got concerning his article. He said it's the most response he's ever received for a post in Global Golf Post. Donald is polarizing, to say the least. I said the same thing about a post I put on my Back Nine blog last week about Trump's comments affecting golf, and also received more comments about it than any previous post I've ever put up. Michael Wan had made some comments about Trump's comments, trying to distance the LPGA Tour from Trump and mentioning that it would not be too late to move the women's – he mentioned that it would be too late to move the women's British from Turnberry at such late date. Trump, to say the least, was not thrilled with Wan's comment. With the RICO Women's British Open scheduled for the end of the month at Trump's Turnberry, Donald fired back at Wan with a letter, a copy of which was posted to jeffshackelford.com. If you guys haven't read this, you gotta go there and read the whole letter. I've got a copy of it laying here, but I'm just going to kind of paraphrase a little bit because it's just too long to read verbatim. But Donald, in the letter, tells Wan that he, Trump, was a supporter of the LPGA Tour when no one else wanted to be involved. He would be happy to allow the LPGA to move the Women's British Open and feels Wan is doing a great disservice to women's golf by making comments against Trump. But he also warns in there, Wan, that as a Universal Universal and NBC are finding out that he, Trump, is a plus five at binding contracts. And in a PS he writes, "Apparently the American public disagrees with you in that I have just gone to number one and number two in the polls." So, you know, is Donald Trump the master at media manipulation or what? We have not heard the last of this whole deal. Let's move on, Kieran, from Dear Donald. I know you want to talk about Phil and his gambling and Tom Watson, and you were at the Scottish Open last week and heard all about it, so tell us about it. Let's get away from Donald Trump.
I must quickly address one point, though, on Donald Trump, actually two. One of them, I'm intrigued by the idea that you had more responses to your article last week about Donald Trump, as did the Global Golf Post. So perhaps it shows you that rather than Tiger getting back to form or Jordan Spieth, what the golf media needs for more hits and more comments is Donald Trump in the news. So maybe a good thing for the golf media. And also, the fact is about the Women's British Open, I'm intrigued by this thing about the LPGA, because in the end, the LPGA don't actually run the Women's British Open. It is the Ladies Golf Union of the United Kingdom. So I'm I think Donald Trump is probably criticizing the wrong people in some way. But yes, on to Phil Mickelson, who himself is a master, like Donald Trump, at making headlines and putting himself out there often and inadvertently. And as you say, Phil was at Gullin last week in Scotland ahead of the Open Championship, preparing at the Scottish Open, as he did, of course, 2 years ago when he won the events back-to-back. And before he addressed in the media, before the championship on the Tuesday, he sought to answer two very important questions before anyone actually asked him anything. And before taking the questions from the guys who were there, the press people, the five-time major champion said outright and addressed them and said, "Before we get started, there's two things that I thought would probably come up. Probably the report came out last week about me. Feel free to ask about it. I probably won't say anything, but feel free to ask. I understand that you have editors and you need to ask questions. But the other thing is, I thought I would be, get asked about Tom Watson. And just the only thing I would say about that is he's one of the greatest champions the game has ever had, and I hope next week is a celebration of that greatness. It's his last Open Championship, and I'm certainly appreciative of all he's done for the game of golf and admire. And that's all I really wanted to say on that. So in the end, Phil, you know, the two questions that everyone there actually wanted to ask him, he answered them. So, and of course, the report he referenced was the alleged link to an illegal $2.75 million sports operation, illegal betting operation. And of course, Phil is not under any federal investigation for this, but the man who allegedly handled his money is. He's a 56-year-old guy called Gregory Silveira, who pled guilty to three counts of laundering money that apparently belonged to Mickelson. So naturally, Phil can't comment on a criminal investigation. That makes perfect sense. So he was obviously trying to prevent any pesky journalist from wasting their time, or indeed wasting his time, probably more pertinently. And on Tom Watson, of course, who will be playing in his final Open Championship this week at St Andrews, five-time champion. And Tom and Phil, as we all remember last September, in a story that ran on for months. You know, you think Donald Trump appears in the headlines for too long. The Phil Mickelson-Tom Watson thing was there forever. It's only just disappeared from the headlines. And they had a rather public fallout at the conclusion of last year's Ryder Cup at Glen Eagles. And you know, when Phil, in the press conference after the event, essentially slaughtered Watson's captaincy in front of the press, his teammates, and of course Tom Watson himself. And it was really the most awkward press conference of all time, and that's even ahead of Tiger Woods' one when he came back from his scandal. That was pretty awkward, but I think the one with Phil Mickelson and Tom Watson, that might have even been worse. And of course, with Watson making his final appearance this week, you know, the topic was likely to come up again for Phil and to address it, and he obviously went out there and just got ahead of the game and answered it. Phil is a very shrewd operator. He's very experienced. He's dealt with the media for so long. He knows how the media guys work, and he's just out there to, you know, in the end, make it easier for himself, and that's fair enough. And of course, Phil has dodged many a bullet on the golf course, as we've seen many times throughout his career. And this week at Gullin, last week at Gullin, you know, he ensured that he would avoid them in his press conference, which again, you know, Phil is the ultimate gambler and he's the ultimate, you know, avoider of trouble, I guess, in a way, and he did so last week. So it's certainly interesting. We'll see how he gets on this week at the Old Course. And Carlos, one man who will also be at the Old Course is Jason Day, who had some very interesting troubles at the Chambers Bay last month. So how's Jason Day doing?
Well, let me tell you about him. His doctors have found an answer and have figured out what's behind the benign positional vertigo he suffered at the U.S. Open in June. They told Golf Channel's Todd Lewis that he was diagnosed by John Oates, and I know Fred is going to get happy about this one because he's a specialist in neurology and vertigo at, yes, Fred, the Ohio State University.
They're the best. They're the smartest.
Yeah. See, I know. That's why I went ahead and said it, you know. So with a viral infection, that's attacking the inner ear nerve in his right ear. Day's now taking medication that drastically reduces the chances of him suffering another episode of vertigo. He has been placed on medication until at least October, but really possibly for the rest of his career to stop the virus from ramping up and causing another episode. Dr. Oates has come to the conclusion after reviewing the results of two sleep studies and some blood samples from the 27-year-old Aussie, the medication is expected to drastically reduce the chances of another vertigo episode, but he has advised the Queenslander he could still have an attack, but the medication should bring those chances well down. While he has some potentially permanent nerve damage, he insists that he is already great and be ready to go at this week's Open Championship. He says it's just a small price to pay to keep his career moving ahead. As for those of you who don't know, benign positional vertigo is the most common form of vertigo, and really it's more of a fancy term to describe the feeling that everything is spinning around you. Day has been dealing with this kinds of symptoms since 2010, according to his wife Ellie, who spoke to GolfChannel.com. And in August 2014, as you might remember, Day withdrew from the WGC Bridgestone Invitational with the symptoms. In May, Day withdrew from the AT&T Byron Nelson for the same reason. This diagnosis is a welcome one for Day as he tries to change his less than stellar performances at the Open. While he has 8 top 10 finishes in majors in 19 starts, including 3 seconds, a third, and a fourth, but none of them have come in the Open, where his best finish is a tie for 30th in 2011. And while he faded from the lead at Chambers Bay last month to finish 9th, he really is taking confidence from that performance because that's a challenging link-style course, and he says that it will help him this week at the Open Championship at St. Andrews. So we are really, really welcoming this news from him and looking forward to see if Jason Day finally will break through and come with a great performance at the Open Championship. Who knows? Maybe he will win it. And now I'm going to turn it over to Fred, who has something to tell us about Lee Elder and some more snubs happening. What's going on?
Well, Carlos, first of all, I could tell you what's wrong with Jason Day. And I've known this for a long time. He's an Aussie. He's from the Southern Hemisphere. The water goes in a reverse fashion down here. He's moved to Columbus. He's moved to Buckeye Land. And the water swirls a different way up here. So he's all, you know, it's just backwards for him. So that's his whole problem right there. He just needs to get that straightened out. But, hey, if you guys remember, we talked about it being the 40th anniversary of Lee Elder becoming the first African-American to earn a spot into the 1975 Masters last April. It did not seem at the time that Augusta National made a big enough deal about that particular moment in sports history, and Lee Elder himself played it down at the time. He's saying something a little different now, however. Speaking with ESPN last week, Elder said, "At Augusta, I felt they should have certainly honored me some kind of way or with a certificate of merit or anything to let the public and the nation know, hey, this man made significant strides and happened to break down the barrier for any person of color. So, yes, I was disappointed, very disappointed." I mean, he had to stay in 2 different houses. He had to move around. He was under death threats. You know, it was a bad time. People don't realize the magnitude of what he accomplished. I mean, it's like Jackie Robinson breaking through in Major League Baseball. The book, The Magnificent Masters, written by Gil Capps, who we had on the Back Nine Report earlier in the year, highlighted the fact that the 1975 Masters was important for several reasons. Jack Nicklaus, Tom Weisskopf, and Johnny Miller battled for the 4 rounds at the 1975 Masters, eventually won by Nicklaus, but it was the first time a man of color was allowed into the field. Elder had qualified by winning the 1974 Monsanto Open in Pensacola the week following the 1974 Masters, which was won by Gary Player. He won in a playoff over Peter Oosterhuis, which I find really interesting. Oosterhuis, of course, is in the news lately for his battle with Alzheimer's. Clifford Roberts and the Masters Tournament had been taking a lot of heat in the press in the 70s for not having African Americans in the field. They had even changed the criteria for entrance into the tournament to invite any PGA Tour winner in hopes of breaking the color barrier at Augusta with a worthy champion. Elder said after his win in Pensacola in 1974, "One of the happiest things is that now that story, the blacks and the Masters, is done with. All of this publicity has given them a kind of bad name." Well, if you remember, Elder was honored this year by the city of Augusta, and a dinner was held in the city this year, but nothing was done inside the gates at Augusta National. Chairman Billy Payne this spring addressed that. He said, "It's a wonderful opportunity for he," meaning Elder, "and his friends. As you perhaps know, and as Lee knows, and has been quoted as saying, we only honor anniversaries as they relate to winners of the tournament. As it relates to Lee specifically on this occasion, we were delighted to make significant credentials available to he and his family so they could enjoy and celebrate this week." Yeah, that's nice. I mean, let's give him a few tickets. They only recognize winners and stuff of the tournament, but, you know, this was a pretty big win for a whole race and for the whole nation, really. So, but anyhow, Elder went on to say, "I felt it was really not my position to do that. I felt they knew the history of what happened and felt if they really wanted to acknowledge it, they would have. I don't think they put enough emphasis on the fact the color barrier had fallen there. Maybe it was not that important to them. I know that it certainly was important to me. In recent years, the Augusta National has added women and blacks to its membership, but Augusta being in Georgia and a bastion of predominantly old southern white businessmen still hasn't shaken the stigma of racial discrimination quite yet. Traditions and time move a little slower in the South. Augusta National may have missed a huge opportunity to make a gigantic statement to sports and the rest of the world last April, guys. Kieran, I hear there's been a reported suspension for substance abuse on the PGA Tour.
Yes, there has, Fred, and I must quickly say about that story on Lee Elder. I think we have to remember here about Augusta National is they, as an organization, as an entity, do not quite simply want to address the previous history because it will bring attention to what how much of a disgusting policy they had and their whole approach to, how, to this issue was very contentious, to say the least. And there are some real ghosts in Augusta in terms of what they did in the past and how they conducted themselves, and that still exists to this day in some ways. However, yes, Scott Stallings, an interesting story here came out last week, and it revealed that the three-time winner on the PGA Tour, the 30-year-old Stallings, you know, he has been suspended for 3 months in the PGA Tour, having violated its anti-doping policy. And Stallings said in a statement released by the PGA Tour itself that he took a supplement to help with chronic fatigue, but he turned himself in to the tour when he realized back in February that it was on the list of banned substances. And he said, I regret my inadvertent mistake in not doing my homework to know for sure what was on the list of permitted and non-permitted substances. I take responsibility and accept the penalty imposed by the PGA Tour. And, you know, as a consequence, he will miss the remainder of this season, the 2014 and 15 season, with the Fries.com Open in October being the first event that he will be eligible to compete in. That's obviously part of next season's schedule and the wraparound schedule that they have nowadays. You know, this is kind of an issue that's going to come up, I think, more often in the future. And credit to him for turning himself in and when he made the error and realized he made the mistake. But I do have two questions about this. And the first question is, one, would the tour itself have actually discovered it for themselves through testing if he hadn't admitted it and turned himself in? Because the PGA Tour's testing policy has been scrutinized and criticized and torn to shreds by just about everybody who's got a knowledge of the subject. And my second question is, well, if it was back in February that he turned himself in, why has the ban not been enforced before now? He's played regularly on the tour since February and, in fact, played at the Greenbrier Classic 2 weeks ago. So those are two questions that I have for the PGA Tour. I'm not sure anyone will actually ask them or they'll get any answers out of them. They're a bit like Augusta National in that way. They keep themselves to themselves. They only tell you what they want to tell you. But the PGA Tour's drug policy and testing process is yet to convince me and yet to convince anybody in that field with the Olympic Games coming up next year, which obviously is a real issue there. And so we'll wait and see what happens there. But, you know, Scott Stallings, will see him back in the PGA Tour in October, and, you know, credit to him for turning himself in, but obviously he made a mistake and we can move on from that. But for the tour itself, it has still a lot of questions to answer on its doping policy and its testing process. And Carlos, you have some news from Cuba, which is obviously one of Donald Trump's favorite countries.
Yeah, no, it might not be one of my favorites, and it's I'm from Puerto Rico, and we call Cuba our sister island. But before going into that, I just have another question also, and I think you hit it on the nail there with it's called Stallings. And your questions, and I would say, maybe has the PGA Tour evolved on its drug policy and the way that it announces the discipline that goes along with violations? I mean, to me, that seems also a real question this week as he begins that, because he did it. Why didn't the PGA Tour took action before? Would have they done it? That question will remain. But anyway, talking about Cuba, what an island. And let me tell you one thing. A general ban on travel to Cuba is still in place for U.S. citizens, with only Cuban Americans allowed to travel to the country. However, legislation was recently introduced in the U.S. Congress to lift this ban. And with relations now improving between the U.S. and Cuba, tourism and real estate are seen by many businesses as the most interesting investments, and the race is on to get in. Golf developers, they don't want to be left behind, and Cuba currently has just one 18-hole golf course but the Caribbean Islands Communist government says it wants to eventually have at least 12 resorts of golf. Wow. A British real estate developer plans to break ground early next year on the communist-run Cuba first luxury golf resort, which is a $500 million project that would be the largest private foreign investment on the island since the fall of the Soviet Union. Ian Livingstone, co-executive chairman of London and Regional, said in a telephone interview from London that construction would begin in the first quarter of 2016 in conjunction with an international builder firm yet to be named. Aside from that, 18-hole course plans include a marina, a 100-room luxury hotel, and more than 1,000 privately owned beachfront condominiums and villas. The state enterprise Palmares S.A. has a 51% stake in the project, as it does with other planned golf resorts. In exchange for its majority stake, Palmares grants land with no property claims attached and allows a renewable 99-year lease on condos and villas. Jose Alonso, the Tourism Ministry Business Director, told official media last week that besides the London and Regional project, Palmares had signed final papers last month with the Beijing Enterprise Group for a similar project to be located between the resort of Varadero and the capital Havana on the country's northern coast. He said a third project would be signed later this year without naming the developer, and that two additional developments were being negotiated with unnamed Spanish firms, also between 1,000 and 2,000 condominiums and villas for sale. But wait, don't start making any plans of going there to play any of those courses if you're an American. Despite the restoration of diplomatic relations, the U.S. embargo prohibits Americans from visiting Cuba as tourists or purchasing homes there. U.S. President Barack Obama could restore diplomatic ties on his own and take further executive action to weaken the embargo, but only the Congress can lift the embargo completely. In the meantime, if you ask why there are no American developers lining up for some of those courses, remember that U.S. developers and hotels companies are also prohibited from operating in Cuba. So if you want to go there, maybe you should be a European citizen like Kieran is, or somewhere else, just not be an American citizen. And that will wrap up.
You go down there, Kieran. You go down there. You come back and tell us all about it, okay?
I've always found Cuba a very intriguing country, and I wouldn't mind visiting there. So, you know, Fred, I'll go over there, I'll play that one golf course, and I'll come on here and give you a full rounded report on all 18 holes.
I want to hear about it. You do that, okay?
Okay,
You can go to all 12 and give us a tour of it, and we'll report it here with you. Okay.
Well, you know, it's a real, it would be an exclusive, you know, the golfing guide to Cuba. You know, that's never been done before. So
you know, there you go.
There you go. We'll back you up on that one. Don't worry. That wraps up our Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. And Fred Alvader, as usual, has some words from our sponsor.
Yes. United Golf Network wants every golfer to enjoy the game more and have the opportunity to earn money while doing it. They offer top line of golf products, Nike, Wilson, Greg Norman, Ashworth, TaylorMade, Adidas, and Where to Win. Everything a golfer needs. They not only have an excellent product line, they offer every golf nut the chance to earn commissions on the products through their director's program. Worth checking out, guys. Also, through their Golf Affinity, they offer discounted travel through Wyndham Endless Vacations. I had someone tell me that they used this perk, and it worked out really well. They got some great discounts. The My Golf in U.S. also, guys were telling me they got some $30 rounds in Myrtle Beach at some of the best courses down there. So if nobody's checking out, they need to be going online and checking this out, and they can do it at UnitedGolfNetwork.com. Check out their products, discounts, and their opportunity, Carlos.
And that wraps up our Par 5 News presented by United Golf Network. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will have our VIG, very important guest of the week, which is Marathon Petroleum's Vice President of Marketing, Tom Kelly. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our VIG segment, the very important guest of the week. His name is Tom Kelly. He's the Vice President of Marketing of the Philly-based Marathon Petroleum, who, along with Owens Corning and Owens Illinois, have all extended their sponsorship on this week's LPGA tournament with the namesake for 3 years through 2018. And Kelly, who is the new appointment for the title sponsor, has expressed his confidence about the long-term health of the relationship, and he separated a few minutes with Fred for this interview. So, Fred, give us a bit about this interview with Tom.
Yeah, just a few words about the Marathon Classic. You know, the LPGA got done with the U.S. Women's Open last week over in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. They move over here to Toledo, Ohio. This is the 30th. Anniversary for the Marathon Classic. Of course, it was known for years as the Jamie Farr Toledo Classic. It generates over $500,000 a year for local children's charities, which is really big for this community. It's one of the longest running tournaments on tour. It's been very successful. And Marathon coming in 3 years ago has really been a huge help to the tournament. It really allows it to be aired all 4 days on the Golf Channel. Go ahead and play. I got a chance to talk to Tom Kelly a month or so ago, and I saved this for today.
Let's play it.
We are talking with Tom Kelly, who is the Senior Vice President for Marathon Petroleum. It was just announced today that Marathon re-signed for a new 3-year contract to be the title sponsor of the Marathon Classic here, the LPGA Tour stop in Toledo. How did that come about?
Well, our original involvement in the tournament really started as an offshoot of our sponsorship with Stacey Lewis. Judd Silverman actually is the one that introduced us to Stacey through her agent. And so the year before 2012, before we became the title sponsor of this tournament, we got into a relationship with Stacey. Really enjoyed being associated with Stacey, all that she represents, a lot of the same values we feel that we portray at Marathon Petroleum Company. And Judd then approached us the following year to say that they were really looking for a title sponsor. And the fact that this is right in our backyard, we are 128-year-old company in Northwest Ohio, with an opportunity to step in and help continue this great tradition that the Toledo Classic Group has put together for now 30 years, that we thought it was going to be a really good value proposition and really good for us to be involved. So that's a little bit of the background of what got us to be the title sponsor of this tournament.
And I think last year the tournament generated about $547,000 for children's charities, and I know that's an important factor for your company also.
Absolutely. You know, our culture is very strong at Marathon in supporting the communities in which we operate. And certainly we can see right here firsthand the impact of our dollars, both in the Toledo area and in the Hancock County area, of the impact of the funds that are raised for these charities. So clearly that fits our mission as a company, and it certainly was a key reason why we got involved in the tournament.
Also, your involvement has allowed the Golf Channel to cover the tournament. Marathon is now going out across the nation through the Golf Channel broadcast and to 160 countries nationwide.
Yeah, certainly that exposure has been very good for us. One of the things we did to try to leverage all of this in the one big package was we actually ran a commercial featuring Stacey Lewis. So the synergy of our sponsorship with Stacey in this tournament, and then the coverage all throughout the country and the world, as you mentioned, has certainly been a nice aspect of being associated with the tournament.
Well, from being here for a long time, we're glad that you, Marathon, got involved, and that we can really see how the tournament is growing and has a good long life going forward.
Yes, certainly 3 decades, and this, from talking to the players, is obviously a very popular stop on the tour. It's hard to beat the Midwest ethic and culture, if you will, and I think the players really respond to the way they're treated here, and we're just really happy that we can be a part of that and look forward to extending the life of this tournament for many years to come.
Thank you again so much for talking to us.
Thank you so much, Fred.
That was the interview with Tom Kelly, the Vice President of Marketing for Marathon Petroleum, and he was there expressing, you know, like we mentioned, that they are extending the life of the sponsorship until 2018. And Fred, what other words you have for us from there? And I believe you have also pretty soon a rant. You're going to talk about Brooke Henderson, so take it away.
Yeah, this is going to evolve into a little bit of a rant, but a couple things. Marathon is really kind of near and dear to my heart, Carlos, in this. First of all, I love this golf tournament. It means so much to this area here. I meant to find out the economic impact today, and I forgot to ask the question. I'm sorry. It's millions of dollars that the LPGA Tour brings to the Toledo area when it comes here every year. It's a really big deal. The other thing is that my dad worked for Marathon, was a Marathon distributor for 50 years. So, and my mother was a secretary at their corporate office way back when she first got out of high school and worked before I was born. I've been around Marathon for a long time. They're a really solid company, and really this partnership with Marathon and the Toledo Classic has gone very well. Second thing is, I put a thing up today on Facebook. Michelle Wee had to withdraw from the Marathon Classic due to her foot and leg injury. She's getting some treatment and getting that looked at so she can get healthy for the British Open. Brooke Henderson, I went out yesterday to Sylvania Country Club where she tried to Monday qualify to get into the Marathon Classic, and she shot a 69. Two other women posted 68. There was only two spots available, so she missed out by one shot. But she played fantastic. She is one heck of a player. I really wanted to see her play, and I got to follow her about five or six holes yesterday. Matter of fact, I was the only person in the gallery, so I was walking right with him. It was really, really, really cool. But anyhow, she stayed off the Canadian Pan Am golf team to come here and Monday qualify, and the Canadian team isn't even allowed to replace her, which looks like a really stupid thing to me. You know, what happens if somebody got sick or something? Didn't they have a plan for that? She shot 68-66 on the weekend at Lancaster Country Club to finish T5. She earned the $140,000, puts her near the $500,000, so she's going to get her card for next year. Why in the world isn't Michael Wan giving her PGA Tour membership so she doesn't have to do stupid things like this and Monday qualify? After finishing up late in Lancaster on Sunday night, she had to make her way to Toledo for this qualifier. I don't get it. She'd be at number 16. On the money list right now, and then without the status, she's got to do these stupid qualifying things. Plus, her number of exemptions, sponsor exemptions, are limited because she's not a tour member. So the bottom line on this is that she's having a great year. She's got money in her pocket. She's having fun playing golf. She's going to be into the British Open. She got to play. She finished top 10 at the Women's PGA. She finished top 10 at the U.S. Women's Open. You know, she's just one heck of a player on a roll. But the bottom line is here, the fans in Toledo aren't going to get to see this young lady play because Michael Wan, for whatever reason, isn't giving her the membership, just going ahead and doing it. So I'm gonna give Mr. Wan a little bit of a warning. I have to say, and you guys know this too, we are big fans of the LPGA Tour and Commissioner Michael Wan. He is the best sports administrator in the professional sports world today. He has done a fantastic job with the LPGA Tour. I don't understand why he's dragging his feet on this one. I hope to get a chance to talk to him on Thursday. I'm going to ask him that question, and if he'll answer it, we'll have it on the show next week. So that's my little bit of a rant for tonight, guys.
Thank God it was little, but anyway, I have to back that up, really. I don't understand why Brooke Henderson is just about, you know, she's not 16 or something like that, and the way she's playing, she should be playing for regular right now. So, Kieran, any final words on this one before we move on to the big one, the practice range?
Well, I agree with everything that Fred said, and as far as I'm concerned, if you're good enough, you're good enough. And it doesn't matter how old you are. If you're good enough to play in the tour, and she clearly is, she's 16th in the money list, really she would be anyway, so she really should be there, and it's a bit of a mockery. She has to go through all these qualifiers, and it's just a it's a shame because fans, as Fred says, want to see her. She's getting a lot of press. She's getting a lot of popularity. She's contended in majors now, so you know she's out there. She's a big name, and it's a shame she's not going to be playing. But I agree with Fred, but I'm with you, Carlos, there. If that's one of Fred's small rants, I'm very glad we didn't have a big one.
Thank God. I was about to press the button here. The mute button.
I'm very grateful for the fact that you only spoke for 5 minutes there. That wasn't too bad.
Yeah. I was scared, but thank God we got through it. Well, guys, that wraps up the very important guest, VIG of the Week segment, and the rant also from Fred. We're going to take a short break before we go now to the practice range. We're going to talk about the Open Championship. Don't go away.
Thank you for listening to the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. We'll be right back. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for the practice range. Every week, we pick a topic, and we take our swings at it on the practice range. But this week is Open Championship week. So, you know, that means wall-to-wall, massive preview coverage for you. So here we are. The stage is set for the third and most historic major of the golfing calendar year, as the best players in the world have gathered in the home of golf this week to do battle for the 144th Open Championship over the historic Old Course in St. Andrews. The U.S. Open began in 1895, the PGA Championship, 1916, the Masters, 1934, but the Open Championship, 1816. No problem, that is checkmate. It's the oldest one and the first one. Now, onto the famous track, though. We've had some truly great winners here, some of the best to ever play the game. You name it, Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Seve Ballesteros, Sir Nick Faldo, Sam Snead, and Bobby Jones. We've all seen the layouts thousands of times in replays and famous open moments, but for those of you that didn't know, the par 72 lies at 7,305 yards, running across the Scottish East Coast near Enfife. The Old Course has 112 individually named bunkers, including the famous Hell Bunker on 14 and the Road Bunker on the 17th. Both have dished out serious pain to many that have succumbed to its sandy ways and can be the difference between a par and a triple bogey. The Old Course looks to be in pristine condition this week, and the players have been full praise for the quality of the surfaces following the practice rounds. And after the rigors of Chambers Bay, the field will be delighted to do battle for a major championship on the greens that run pure and true. A decent amount of rainfall leading up to this event means the golf's grand old ladies looking greener than for some past championship. And however, the weather forecast for the week looks relatively unsettled, and squally showers could be a feature. As with any links course, the wind might be a significant factor there at St. Andrews. Last time the Open was here was 2010. Conditions favored one side of the draw considerably, and there's every chance that good fortune in terms of tee times could play a part against this time out. Kieran, history and current suggestions, and current conditions suggest the big hitters might have a great advantage this week, but also long putters should, because conditions should be soft for those big long greens. How about the history and the course of this Open Championship?
Well, as I said at the start of the show, Carlos, you know, the Open goes to the Old Course every 5 years, and there is no finer venue in the game. St Andrews is a small town with a great history and a great vibrancy to it, and it comes completely alive during Open Week. You know, you can walk around the high street there, and you can see people like Arnold Palmer and Peter Thomson and Tom Watson just wandering around. It's a real kind of carnival of golf. The golf world comes together every 5 years in St Andrews. And, you know, 28 Open Championships have been there in the past. There's so much history. The game as we know it now was essentially born there. You know, why do we have 18 holes in golf? Well, because that's what St Andrews had. It used to be 22. They reduced it to 18, and that became the regulation. And so much has occurred there. And it's been a timeless challenge as well. The golf course is one of the most intriguingly strategic in the world. It takes many visits to try and understand it. That's why I think many players in the past have had issues with it at the start. They could walk around the golf course and think, you know, what's going on here? There are bunkers that aren't even in play in certain holes half the time. But then when you go back the next time, the wind changes direction or picks up, and suddenly those bunkers that may have seemed oddly placed suddenly become fearsome obstacles. So the golf course takes a lot of learning. Over time, you grow to appreciate it and then grow to love it. No one was, you know, that rang no more true for anyone than Bobby Jones, who in 1921 ends up in the Hill bunker on the 11th hole, the par 3, and he couldn't get out of it. He tore up his scorecard and walked off and vowed never to come back. But he did. In 1927, he won the Open at St Andrews, and in 1930, he won the Amateur Championship at St Andrews, and it became his favourite golf course in the world, and he modelled his Augusta National masterpiece on the Old Course. There are so many different ways to play it. Generally speaking, you're always advised when you play there to aim down the left side off the tee, because that avoids most of the trouble, but consequently that usually gives you a more difficult second shot. To get an easier second shot into the big greens, you have to take on the bunkers and take on the tight lines down the right side of the fairway. So in that respect, the golf course in my mind has always been the subtlest and perhaps the greatest risk and reward course in the world. There are so many interesting and fascinating holes, and you look at the fourth hole, stands out to me. It's a real difficult tee shot. You have the seventh, it's got a unique green. And then you have the 11th, is one of the best par 3s in the game. The number 12 is one of the most incredible holes I've ever played, one of the great shot par 4s where there are six bunkers in the fairway and you can't see any of them off the tee, because the golf course back in the day was originally played in reverse. So you'd play from what is now the first tee to the 17th green, the second tee to the 16th green, and so on, and it was played that way. So the actual golf course makes more sense backwards than it does forwards in some ways. So it's there are many ways to play it. Obviously, the conditions are so crucial in the Old Course. With the soft conditions this week, it changed it slightly in the respect that players can be more aggressive with their second shots into the greens, but it always remains a challenge to not just avoid the bunkers, which will become easier when the fairways are left.
Carlos, you still there? Carlos, you still there?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, I'm still
apparently,
here.
Apparently, Kieran, we lost Kieran here.
We're getting feedback also.
Apparently, there's something going on with the transmission. Let's see.
How we can fix this.
We really lost Kieran. Let's see if we can get him back. Can you listen to me now?
I can hear you now. We're not getting the feedback.
Okay,
that's good.
Yeah, I think it was something with Kieran. Hopefully we'll get him back. So while he's back, let's see your take on the history and the course of St. Andrews and the Open Championship.
Yeah, he was doing such a great job. I was really enjoying listening to him, and I have questions for him, actually, that I wanted to ask him. But as you mentioned, the first Open Championship was held in 1860, so it's been around for 155 years. Willie Park Sr. Won the very first tournament held back in 1860. Held at Prestwick. Kieran's back.
I'm back. I don't know what happened. Yeah. That, gentlemen, I don't know what happened there. I cut off.
Why don't you, Kieran, why don't you go ahead and finish what you were talking about, and then I'll come in after you're done.
Well, you know, I was going to say that, you know, the Old Course, you know, I've played it a few times, and I've walked it many times, and it changes every time you go there, and that's why the players enjoy the challenge of it. The course is in magnificent condition, probably the best it's ever been. You've seen the images of the grandstands that are there. It's a tremendous amphitheatre. There's no finer setting in the game than that. The holes in the town, the 1st and the 18th and the 17th there, the grandstands are wrapped around that. And this week when we see Tom Watson playing his final Open, then when we see the finish on Sunday with the players going for the title, it's going to be a bit of excitement. And the golf course, I say it's a risk and reward course in so many ways, so low scores are possible, but also disasters are out there if you find the wrong spot and you get into trouble. And with the wind forecast to pick up on Friday and Saturday, the old lady is going to show some teeth. So it's going to be, it's always interesting. The Open Championship is always special. But I think Jack Nicklaus said it best. When the Open's in Scotland, it's special. But when it's at St Andrews, it's even more special because it's a very special place. It's a storied place, an historic place. And the golf course has a real knack for finding and identifying the best player in the game at that time. Thompson, Nicklaus, Ballesteros, Faldo, Woods, Bobby Jones, Sam Snead, and even the guys who aren't quite on that level, Louis Oosthuizen and John Daly and players like Kel Nagel, they were all tremendous players. The golf course has a real ability to identify the best players, and that is to its credit. So we should expect something very exciting. There's so much history potential to be made, Jordan Spieth, and so many great storylines. So it's, as always, it's going to be a very special and storied occasion. The Open at St Andrews is the grandest occasion in golf.
So, Fred, now can you then go on with what you were saying and completing what Darren was saying?
I was just going to say, it did start in 1860. Willie Park Sr. Won the first one. Between Willie Park Sr., Tom Morris, they pretty much won the first 10 or 11 tournaments. There was a couple other guys stuck in there, but those guys dominated. In the first 11 years, it was played at Prestwick. And was not played at St. Andrews until 1873. It does have a long history. As Kieran says, it has a penchant for identifying the best golfers of the time. Now, whether they, just are that much better, I don't understand it. But the leaderboard always seems to have the big names at the top. There is a rotation. It is moved around. There's five courses that are used in Scotland, Carnoustie, St. Andrews, Muirfield, which are all relatively close together, and then Royal Troon and Turnberry on the other coast, on the western coast of Scotland. Then there are also some courses in England, in the UK. You've got Royal Lytham, Royal Liverpool at Hoylake, and then you have Royal St. George's and also Royal Birkdale. Birkdale, Lytham, and Hoylake are all up on the northwest coast of England, while Royal St. George's is way down to the southeast. And then it was played one time at Royal Portrush in Northern Ireland, and they're trying to get it back to there at some point in time again. It's a tremendous history, and I have to say that when I was younger, I just didn't get it. I didn't understand the fascination with Scottish golf. You would see it on TV and think, why would anybody want to play on that stuff? If you over here, we wouldn't, it'd be a goat pasture and nobody would even play on it. But as you begin to appreciate the history of golf and what really is involved there on the true links style courses, and I've played links type courses here in the U.S. I begin to understand the humps and bumps and the way you have to move the ball and when wind comes into play, and so it is a different style of golf, and we're seeing a lot of it this year really with Chambers Bay, now St. Andrews. We'll have Whistling Straits here also in a few weeks for the PGA. So it's just a little different style, Carlos, but it's a good style.
Thank God you recovered from that one that you were saying you didn't understand what it's about to play there and all that. I mean, if I could hear or feel anything through a phone, I would feel Kieran about to say blasphemy to you.
Yes, Carlos, I was tensing up there as Fred was going through that speech there, and I was about to jump in and just tear him to shreds, but I've he saved himself there at the end.
Yeah, he did.
You know what? I mean, that's true. I mean, when I, you know, when I started playing golf, you know, back, you know, in my 20s, you know, and I would see that, you know, on TV, I think, why would anybody want to do that? We just didn't get it.
Fred, you know, here's the best example of that. You know, Tom Watson, who won 5 Open Championships and is arguably the best links player of all time, certainly from the United States. And he first came to Scotland in 1975 to play the Open at Carnoustie. He had a practice round at nearby Monifieth, which is a traditional links course. And the first tee shot he hit there was a perfect drive straight down the middle of the fairway. And when he got down to the fairway, he couldn't find the ball. And he and his playing partner looked around, and eventually they found it in a bunker that was 50 yards away and invisible from the tee. And for years, Tom Watson had a real dislike and distaste for the ground game and for links golf. He didn't like the idea of having to play the ball on the ground. He didn't like the bounces and the unpredictability. He couldn't get his head around it. Despite that, he won 3 Open Championships at that time. But then, in 1981, he travelled around the country with his friend Sandy Tatum, who was a former USGA president. They played Royal Dornoch and Ballybunion in Ireland and Prestwick, and he grew to love it. And now he's one of the great links aficionados. He finally accepted the challenge, and he enjoyed, embraced the differences from what he was used to when he grew up. And he realized that in many ways that links golf requires not just the test of execution, but you've got to think your way around the golf courses. You've got to realize that you've got to play for the bounce, play for the roll, play for the conditions. And it's a more rounded test. It's not just a test of simply hitting shots over and over again. The best players in the world, they can all do that. But what separates the best players in the world is how they think and how they can strategize themselves around a golf course that is at times somewhat uncooperative. So links golf courses for me, you know, I play all kinds of golf courses in this country, inland courses, parkland courses, links courses, and for me, links is the most intriguing test of them all, and I would recommend to anybody to come over here, come over to Ireland, come over to England, Scotland, and try it out for yourself, because it's a different way to play the game, but a really enjoyable and different test.
Hey,
Kieran, Carlos, if I can, I want to ask Kieran, talk about the changes a little bit to St. Andrews. There are some changes this year. I know there's you know, some of the guys are talking about the change to number 17 in particular on the road hole.
Yeah, well, they've made some changes. About 2 years ago, in fact, it was very controversial because the old course hasn't architecturally had any changes done to it for over half a century to this point. Some of the bunkers have changed size down the years. The road hole bunker in particular has changed many times. In fact, you look back at pictures from the 1970s, the road hole bunker was a lot smaller than it is now, and it wasn't as high. Then in 2000, when David Duval got in there in the final round against Tiger Woods, he couldn't get out of the roadhole bunker. And you actually watched the images. David Duval is about 6 feet tall, and you couldn't see him. You couldn't see his head when he was inside the roadhole bunker. It was far too deep and far too severe. Now it's somewhat in between that. But they changed some of the routing of the ground there. Most of the old course itself is often said it's made by nature. The ground is just natural in the way it's laid out, and all the humps and bumps have always been there. However, they've manufactured some of them this year. They've made a few changes, making the road hole bunker somewhat more in play. And in the past, in the road hole, in fact, players could actually aim left of the green, avoid the road hole bunker entirely, and almost aim towards 18th tee and try and get up and down from that side. But they've actually changed the routing of that as well, meaning that you aim left of the road hole bunker, the fairway will actually roll towards the road hole bunker, so now it's even more in play than before. That's perhaps a bit gimmicky. They also made changes to the second hole. They put 2 bunkers, actually, front right of the green, which weren't there before, making it more difficult for players. Obviously, before, there wasn't anything there at all, so if you missed the green, you had to putt it up from that slightly bumpy surface. The most other significant change was actually the 11th hole, the par 3, where there used to be a very sloping green from back to front, and they reduced the slope on the left side of it because with modern green speeds, they couldn't put penny pin positions on the left side. So now this year, it's reduced it slightly, so they can now put pin positions up the left side of the green, which actually brings in the Bobby Jones bunker back in play than before. And in the past, obviously, look at 5 years ago when the wind actually took the Open out of action on Friday. They had to abandon play because balls were actually rolling off the 11th green. Because it's very severe, they've reduced the severity of it, so it's unlikely that balls will roll off the green now. So the changes that were made, they were controversial because for many people, the old course is hallowed ground. You shouldn't touch it. It should be timeless. The changes do make sense, what they've done. However, I think the argument is, well, why have they done it? Well, because the golf ball goes too far. To keep the golf course relevant to today's standards, they've had to joke it up and made changes to it. So rather than address the issue of the equipment. So people are, the purists don't like the changes, but I think the players who have been this week, you know, Jeff Ogilvie, who's a real purist and an expert in golf architecture, he's played the golf course, he loves the old course anyway, but he's appreciated the changes that were made and thinks they've improved it. And the old course itself, it's advanced and it's developed over time, and that will certainly continue. So the players this week, a couple of the changes will be noticeable, but for most guys, it will be the same course as before.
And that's great news, because we are all going to benefit from seeing that this weekend. Hey, guys, this week's field will be missing the world's top player. Rory McIlroy will not be back to defend his title after tearing a ligament in his ankle playing soccer a couple weeks ago. Well, it's football to the rest of the world. Rory, he completed the third leg of the career Grand Slam last year and at Royal Liverpool and won by two shots. He's still looking for a Masters title to complete the Grand Slam. There's still plenty of big storylines remaining, however, with the biggest one being the reason why Rory is still winless at the Masters, and his name is that of world's number two, Jordan Spieth. He's coming off a playoff win at last weekend's John Deere Classic, and he's looking to become the first player since Ben Hogan in 1953 to win the Masters, U.S. Open, and British Open in the same season. Excitement is increasing over this 21-year-old golfing for a Grand Slam, and it's not just excitable fans who have high hopes for Spieth. Normally, cool-headed bookmakers and gamblers are giving him also a real chance as well. If you want to take a chance on him and see why, I mean, Rory McIlroy, the world's number one, has been the favorite in every tournament for the bookers, and he's been 6-1 or 7-1 in all majors. Now Jordan Spieth is 5-1, so that should tell you how much people are betting and looking for him to win. And that's the question: what are the chances of him winning here and eventually winning the Grand Slam? But he has to go through the Open Championship at St. Andrews, and in my opinion, he has his best chance as anyone. He should be the favorite anyway, because the way he's playing, his confidence, and we had talked about this before. He has played in Chambers Bay, which is a great links course style golf course, and if he won there, I mean, the other two that are coming up, the St. Andrews and Whitling Straits, are also links style golf courses, and he should be, I mean, he has to be considered the favorite, and to me, he's the favorite to win here this week. So, Fred, I'm going to give you the first one to answer on this one.
We're just talking about picks here, and I guess I'm picking the easy ones, but you know, top guy.
Fred, first, before going to the picks, let's talk about Jordan Spieth's winning chances, and then
I'm sorry. Yeah, Jordan. Yeah, you got to pick him. You know, I'm sorry. You just gotta, you know, to watch what that guy's done over the last 2 months, just unbelievable. He just denies to, you know, he just refuses to lose. So the mental toughness. He doesn't worry about what it looks like. He doesn't worry about where the shot's at. He just takes the challenge and go. It reminds me so much of the way Tiger used to play. He didn't worry about where his club was in the backswing. He didn't worry about where the ball was. He just hit it, went and found it, figured out how to get in the hole with the fewest shots. And that's exactly what Jordan Spieth's doing right now. I think he's got a great shot at it, guys. I really do.
How about it, Kieran? What do you think?
Well, I think certainly you have to make him favorite to win the championship, given his record this year and what he's achieved and his a real ability to do remarkable things. And he's comfortable coming in great form, having won his last two events at Chambers Bay and the John Deere Classic. But the question is, of course, how quickly will he be able to learn and get the old course of St. Andrews? He's played it once before this week. That was back in 2011 when he played a practice round there of his Walker Cup teammates. He's played it on a simulator, a video game, in recent weeks, trying to get understanding for the sights and the visuals of the course. And he arrived there on Monday afternoon. But, you know, you talk about the time change and adjusting to it. One player in history has actually won the week before in the PGA Tour, then won the Open. That was Lee Trevino, I think, back in 71. He won the Canadian Open, then the Open at Muirfield. But for Jordan Spieth, I think he's someone who can... He's a strategist. He likes the map of the way around golf courses. and the old course, being so strategic in nature, will lend itself to his game plan. He'll map out all the bunkers and know where to hit it. He'll have good advice from people. He'll be studying the golf course all this week ahead of a championship. But then, you know, the unknown is obviously he hasn't really played here in competition before. But you know, the guy's achieved remarkable things. And then the theory that, well, perhaps you can't win them all, can you? Really? Maybe he can. But you know, he certainly, all attention is going to be on him this week, more than before, obviously, with Rory McIlroy not being there. Rory was the favourite going into this week before his injury because of his record at the old course. Jordan is coming in here. You know, he won in, you know, Augusta and Chambers Bay, two completely different golf courses. Chambers Bay was a links course on steroids. It was you know, excessive beyond belief. The old course is far more sedate and subtle in its challenges. And I think Jordan Spieth will play well. Whether he wins or not, I'm not sure, but I think he'll have a decent week. But the question is, well, how will he handle the changing conditions? Will he get some fortune with the wind? And you know, how quickly can he get his head around playing the old course? Those are the questions for him to answer this week. But you know, Jordan Spieth, he's achieved remarkable things this year, and it would not be a shock if he won the Claret Jug on Sunday.
Okay, so we all agree he has to be the favorite, and everybody's expecting him to be the one that has to be beat. Now, if not him, who? We have to talk about what would happen with the big names and everything else on our picks. Hey, Tiger Woods, is he done? He says no, but I don't think he still needs some more reps to be really contending. I would like to see him first play a little some more. And if he wins, well, great. You beat me and beat everybody else. Nobody's expecting him to win. Phil Mickelson, hey, it's just like he can turn that switch on and play well in the majors. You can never count him out. But now, when you talk about my leading contenders, I would have to say Dustin Johnson. I mean, his year has been marvelous, and he just, you have to remember, he just three-putted there for the final hole at the U.S. Open in June to give the title to Spieth. I mean, many, including me, will be hoping that his memory is shorter than his missed the U.S. Open putts, and he can try to go against Jordan Spieth again and maybe be in that final group and give us that rematch that we're all looking forward. At least I'm looking forward to it. He's going to be paired with Spieth and Hideki Matsuyama over the first 2 days, so I'm looking for Dustin Johnson to do good here. I'm going to tell you another guy, of course. Well, I wouldn't pick him, Sergio Garcia, but this time you have to know. He boasts no less than 8 top 10 finishes at the Open, and he's one of the game's most skilled performers on the links. I mean, the windy forecast will certainly help him this week, and he has a T36, but he was third halfway in 2000, 2005, he finished T5 here at St. Andrews, T14 in 2010, so he's one to look forward to. Also, I look forward to Paul Casey playing well. I mean, he was playing that in final group with Hoos Tyson in the 2010 Open at St. Andrews, and he was being champion as the man to become the first English winner of the Open since Nick Faldo in 1990, but he failed with a 75, still ended T3, and his form is great lately. My other two picks that I would have to say have to be Brooks Koepka. I mean, St. Andrews appeared to be kind to these big-hitting Americans, and he could follow in the footsteps of Tiger Woods and John Daly, maybe. Who knows? You know, he certainly took to the course at the 2014 Alfred Dunhill Links and fired 64 and 68 in his first two rounds. And to me, that's one of the things I look forward to, because, you know, if you see the Dunhill Links forms, even though only two of the four rounds are played here, if you see somebody that plays well there, could play well here. And I have to pick also Martin Keimer this week, even though he hasn't been under radar lately. Hey, he's a fine performer here with lots of good rounds. They're helping him to find a win in a second place in the Alfred Dunhill Links Championship. So look for him. I think he's going to play well this weekend because of his form there. And my dark horse would be Tommy Fleetwood. He's mind-bending, 26 under for his last four rounds at St. Andrews. So those are my picks to win here. If not Jordan Spieth, those are mine. So, Kieran, go ahead, go first, and let us know what are your picks.
Well, Carlos, I've got to quickly say, you know, we usually criticize Fred for picking everybody in the field, but for goodness sake, Carlos, you almost picked everyone there. In the name of God, the only person who didn't pick is Nick Faldo, for goodness sake. So,
And the first,
you see he went first this time, Jerry. You see he went first, didn't you?
Well, he did. He strategically went first there for a very important reason, because he used to pick everyone he wants to pick. So, Carlos, you know, fair play for getting your own back on us here. But yeah, you know, all those guys mentioned there, I think they'll have very good weeks. Tommy Fleetwood, you know, he's actually 41 under par for his last 8 rounds at the Old Course. Is jointly holding the course record of 62 that he recorded in the Dunhill Links last year. So he's someone who could go quite well. For my picks, well, I agree with those guys. I think they could all do very well, particularly Dustin Johnson. His power can count for a lot. Paul Casey also has played well here in the past. But I'm going to avoid those guys and go elsewhere. And I'm going to look at Shane Lowry as being potentially someone who could come through and win this. You know, a guy who played very well at Chambers Bay, took a lot of confidence in that week. He has a great record in Lynx Course. He has a good record in the Old Course. He enjoys it. And I think he's a player with a real touch and feel for the game, particularly around the greens. That's very crucial at the Old Course, where there's a lot of putting from long distances. And I think he's going to be very, very good at that. So Shane Lowry could be someone who threatens on Sunday. And I also look at, from an American point of view, I look at even Brant Snedeker as being someone who could have a good week. Brant Snedeker played well at the Chambers Bay as well. He's had a good summer so far. He's played well this season, very consistent. And Snedeker's someone who he's playing alongside Tom Watson, actually, in his final open this week in the first 2 rounds. And Snedeker, you know, he's played well in Lynx courses in the past. He played well at Royal Livermore a couple of years ago, back in 2012. And he's a very good putter, and I think that will count for a lot this week, obviously. And I think he's a good attitude as well, and the attitude is very important. When you look at the windy conditions that are forecast, particularly on Saturday and Friday afternoon, it's going to get very windy, very wet, and patience and a strong mental state are going to be very important this week. And I think Brant Snedeker has the right attitude for that. I think he could have a very strong week and go quite far. But you know, elsewhere, yeah, people say experience is important, and I think Louis Oosthuizen, obviously winning here 5 years ago, he, you know, ultimately he was the best player at the US Open for the last 3 days by far. Actually, in fact, if Louis Oosthuizen shot level par on the Thursday at Chambers Bay, he would have won the event by 6 shots. So Louis is in unbelievable form right now. He loves the Old Course, obviously, and I think he quite close to actually maybe winning a second Open at St Andrews. And but in the end, I said at the start of the piece here, the Old Course has had a record, an ability to identify the best players in the game, time in, time out, through each era within the game. And look at Jordan Spieth, Dustin Johnson, players like that. Those are the leading players in the game right now. And I think perhaps it's hard to see beyond one of those guys. But what if Tiger Woods? Well, you know, Tiger Woods, I've got a feeling Tiger might play quite well this week. I don't think he'll win the event. Back to see Tiger finishing in the top 20. I think experience counts for a lot at the Old Course, and I think he loves it so much. It's his favourite golf course in the world. He's been here since the weekend, and I think Tiger will do all right. But for my pick to win, you know, I think Shane Lowry could be the guy that comes through and surprises everybody and, you know, gets an Irish winner at the Open again.
So there are Kieran Clark's picks, and how about you, Fred? I know you're going to pick there Ricky Fowler somewhere.
I want to congratulate you guys. You have all pretty much listed like the top 20 in the odds for everybody here. So you guys have done a great job, okay? So, and then I have to qualify that with my top 4 picks that I picked these independently, and I later today, after I had already done this, I printed off the odds sheet. And my 4 picks were the top 4 odds makers. So evidently the gamblers and I think just alike.
What a coincidence.
Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler, and Justin Rose. You know, what more do you need to say? A couple guys you didn't – well, let me qualify also Tiger. Kieran, I'm with you on Tiger. I think he's going to play pretty well this week. But I don't think he is – up to handling the pressure of being up on the leaderboard. I would be very surprised to see him win, but I think he could top 10 very easily. Somebody that nobody mentioned, though, is Adam Scott, and he's off at a 22-1. You know, I think he won one of these things, if I recall, or was pretty close. I guess he was pretty close to winning. He let Ernie Els win at the end, but, I mean, he could win one of these things. Phil Mickelson is clear down to 33-1. You know, it's hard to count him out. Snedeker's in there, as somebody mentioned him, at 50-1. Brooks Koepka. Nobody's talked about Matt Kuchar, Patrick Reed, or Jimmy Walker. Those guys are all right around 50-1. They're in about the top 21 or 22 names. So, I don't know, guys. Just I really think the winner is going to come from one of the four: Jordan Spieth, Dustin Johnson, Ricky Fowler, Justin Rose. I really think that's going to happen. If not, they're going to be filling out the top five in the thing. You know, Tiger could have a good week, but I don't think he'll win.
So we agree on that one. Tiger should play well, but I don't think he'll win. There you have it, folks. That's our massive wall-to-wall preview coverage of the men's golf third major, the Open Championship. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to have our final putts. So don't go anywhere. Stay here.
Thank you for listening. We'll be right back. In the meantime, don't forget to visit www.edraft.com for analysis, breaking news, and more. Also, remember to follow us on Twitter at @edraftsports and on Facebook at facebook.com/edraftsports. Don't forget to check out our co-hosts on Twitter by clicking their names in the episode description. Now, back to the show.
And we're back, and now it's time for our final pods. And guys, hey, don't worry, we have a couple of minutes after the 30, so take your time and do your final putts. And we're going to start with Kieran Clark, who's going to talk to us about a course there at Hoylake that is being carved up. What's going on?
Yeah, Carlos, so, there's a proposed Hoylake Golf Resort to be created near Royal Liverpool Golf Club, where the Open Championship was played last year. And World Council will present the latest plans for the resort to the UK government on July the 20th, later this month. And the proposed golf resort is an opportunity to make Wirral, which is the village where Hoylake is, to become one of the capital of England's golf coast, the west coast of England, where Fred Nationdeli have courses like Birkdale and Livham, all on that same stretch of land. And you know, Wirral's a big part of that. And so they're very excited about, but their proposal includes an 18-hole championship course designed by Jack Nicklaus's design firm, and as well as a Lynx Academy, where visitors can learn about the unique challenges of Lynx golf, very similar to what you see at the old course of St Andrews. So we shall wait and see what happens there. And you know, Jack Nicklaus is very excited about it. He said, "I'm delighted that World Council is recommending us as a partner for its golf resort in Hoylake. Hoylake has a rich history in the game of golf, being close to Royal Birkdale, Royal Livingston Ann's, and of course Royal Liverpool right next door." And he also said, "I know it's going to be a very special project in the Hoylake area, which is going to add to the legacy of golf in Wirral. We're looking forward to it very much, and we can't wait to get started." So it should be interesting to hear how this develops in the coming weeks, whether it goes ahead and whether it's allowed to go ahead, given the green light. I expect it will be. But for Jack Nicklaus, who I've had many issues with his golf courses in the past, I think he builds quantity rather than quality. It's taken him 40 years to get Muirfield Village quite right, and his other golf courses aren't very good. And the one golf course he has in Scotland, of course, is the PGA Centenary at Glen Eagles, which is the worst golf course I've ever played. So hopefully Nicklaus does a much better job with his golf course down in Hoylake, because if he does, it will certainly complement what is a fantastic stretch of a golfing coastline in the northwest of England.
Okay, so there you have it. That's proposed, you said, right? It's not official
yet. That's proposed, yeah.
Proposed. Well, hopefully it turns out to be right and it's done. Hey, I have something to tell you about, you know, as Housing Wire first reported a couple of Thursdays ago, Maurice Schneider-Wittstedt officially filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy on Monday. The firm did not open for business on Monday, but went so far as to tell all employees not to bother reporting to work on Monday morning. But you might be wondering, who in the world is Maurice Schneider-Wittstedt? Well, if you might remember, that is the Georgia-based law firm and its partners, which made national headlines last year when Dustin Johnson accused that firm and the firm's partners of using their positions as Johnson's trusted advisors to steal from him to cover shortages in the firm's accounts, allegedly created by one of the managing partners himself. Then the firm sued that former managing partner for allegedly embezzling $30 million from the firm's accounts and the accounts of the firm's subsidiary, Landcastle Title. They allegedly told the firm's employees that the firm intended to file for bankruptcy and that the firm's staff would not be paid for the last 3 weeks of work. You know, apparently, and according to their statements, the Dustin Johnson lawsuit and the ensuing scandals with the sale for merger with the firm Butler & Hodge severely impacted their business, and that's why they are, you know, going for filing for bankruptcy. But despite all this, Dustin Johnson say, hey, no way, Jose. I have declared that I am not going to give up my fight, and you're going to have to give me my money back. So this is going to be in for a long while, so we'll keep you posted on it. And Fred, you have the final thoughts for today. What do you have in store for us?
Yeah, just real quick, guys. Tim Clark was eligible for the Open Championship, but he found out too late to get clearance into the U.K. Evidently, it's really difficult for South Africans to enter England, and the RNA wouldn't help Clark circumvent the rules. And so Tim's eligible, but he can't get there, so he had to get a sub. The World Golf Hall of Fame ceremony was held yesterday evening at St. Andrews, but Laura Davies was unable to make it in time for the formal induction. She played in the U.S. Women's Open at Lancaster, Pennsylvania, finished T47, was done by 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, but due to airline snags, could not get to St. Andrews in time. I think this is a travesty. She should have been able to get to Scotland early on Monday morning. Why didn't the Hall of Fame organizers have a plane waiting for her on Sunday evening? The guys from the John Deere Classic made it for practice rounds on Monday afternoon, and they were an hour and a half farther west away from Scotland to begin with. You know, 6 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time was when she could have left there. 5 hours flying time is 11 p.m. plus 5 hours time difference puts her in there at 4 a.m. in the U.K. I don't understand it. She would have had plenty of time to get a nap, freshen up for the Monday evening ceremony. Very poor planning by the World Golf Hall of Fame for something as important to Dame Laura as this. And I want to know, we need a full investigation. Did the Queen know about this? The RAF should have been put on alert. They should have had a jet and get her over there. Alex Mastelli is reporting that the International Golf Federation has pushed a proposed test golf tournament at the Olympic Golf Course in Rio back to sometime in early 2016, feeling it is best to let the course have one more season to fill in before hosting an event. Arnold Palmer and Jack Nicklaus have been named the honorary chairman for the 2016 U.S. Open to be held at Oakmont. And, of course, we remember that Jack won his first U.S. Open at Oakmont, where he beat Arnold in the playoff in 1962. So that has a special place in both of their hearts. So that should be a great event next year right over here at Pittsburgh. And that's all I have. Carlos, back to you.
Well, Back Niners, that wraps up another week of the Back Nine Report presented by eDraft.com. It's always our pleasure to bring you the latest on the world of golf. Thank you for listening to us for the past 90 minutes. Thank you to Kieran Clark for being with us this week, another week. It's always great to have your input, your insight. You're very savvy in golf, and we enjoy, and I'm sure the fans do. Special thanks also to our VIG, very important guest of the week, Tom Kelly, VP of Marketing for Marathon Petroleum. Don't forget to join us again next Tuesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time here on Block Talk Radio, and also through TuneIn or download our show on iTunes. If you haven't done so, follow the show. Our Twitter ID is @Back9Report with the number 9 in the middle. My name is Carlos Torres. Alongside Fred Alvader and Kieran Clark, we wish you to be happy, be blessed, and enjoy the great game of golf. Happy golfing, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.